listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got Martin Page. Martin.
Heroes never die.
They leave their trails across the sky.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. You had to get it.
It's the way we sell our 80s songs.
Only the best.
That wasn't rehearsed, by the way. That just came out of the air. No, it's nice to be here anyway, Mike. Nice to be here.
And next in, we've got Bobby Osinski. Bobby.
Hey, Mike. Hey, everybody.
And next in, we've got Brandon Bertine.
What's up, Mike?
And joining us all the way from Philadelphia, Rob.
Yeah.
Yep. Sounds like he's just yelling from Philadelphia. Rob Armentier, keeping his streak alive, Rob.
Hello there, Mike. Hello, everybody. I am keeping the streak alive. How many is this?
This is 124.
Wow. Amazing. Dedication.
Show 124. Mm. See?
So I could theoretically go to bed right now because I'm on East Coast time. And
that's true.
Do I keep the streak alive or do I got to sit here for an hour?
You know what? You got to sit here for an hour, okay? If you have to be up, you got to be up.
I'm looking forward to it.
And joining us today for part two of our talk on the 80s is the one and only Brad Fairweather.
There
Brad.
Is only one.
There can only be one.
Thank God for that.
First of all, hey, guys, missed you. Missed all of you. It's been a while since we did our last podcast.
Yes,
I think
it
was like
yesterday.
5 weeks. 5 weeks or so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yesterday.
It was only yesterday, Mike.
This is part two. it's good to be back. A lot has happened. First of all, we've lost a couple guys. Where's Bobby?
Anybody? I know. You know, he I thought Bobby was coming tonight. I mean, his email said he was coming.
Yeah,
and I wanted to introduce him to my Q-Fill partner.
He had half the show right there talking about his new board, but
that's
well.
Right. Yeah. I'm very disillusioned with the man.
Anyway, the reason why Brian's back is because we're going to talk a little bit more about the 80s, amongst other things. We're also going to talk about self-editing. And that's really important because I've got a couple of emails that I want to – well, I won't share the emails with you, but I'll share what some of the content is, and you'll see why we're going to talk about that. But before we even get into the emails in the 80s, today is an important day.
I know what you're going to say. It's a 30-year anniversary of CDs.
Yep, of the compact disc. And that was the – well, first of all, it was the first technology which made us all rebuy our own music.
That's right.
Since we've done it another time.
Yeah. And a lot of times it sounded worse, but we still bought it, didn't we?
But when you think about the compact disc, I mean, it was truly revolutionary. I remember when I first heard, you know, a compact disc, and I wasn't really even into music or anything, but I immediately noticed that sound seemed to have come out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. Just kind of – there was no hiss. There was no there was no any type of character to the medium. It was like transparent at that time. I mean, later on, you start listening to those old compact discs and you realize that it was, you know, it had its own sound because of how poorly some of those first recordings were. But having said that, it truly was remarkable when the first compact disc. Anybody remember the first time they heard a compact disc?
Yeah. It was
Brandon was like three.
I had to have been in about fifth grade or sixth grade or so, and it was Def Leppard Hysteria.
Was it really?
And it was at, this girl who lived behind our house, and she had, her dad had a CD player, and if you danced around the room, the thing would skip. You like had to stand still.
Oh, yeah. That's right. At the very beginning, they were really temperamental. And they were also like $1,500 for a CD player. What about you, Bobby? You remember the first CD players?
Yes, at trying to think of the mastering house. It was on Cahuenga, famous place that isn't there anymore. But anyway, they played me some things that they were doing. No, it was Future Disc. And I remember them playing some stuff. And at the time, they had one of the first CD burners, which cost them $50,000.
Wow. Oh, smokes.
And each disc was $250, each CDR.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Wow.
Is that before you put anything on it? $250?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's when a typical mastering session was $2,500, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000. Yeah.
What about you, Rob? You remember the first time you heard a CD?
I do. My first CD player was a Phase Linear.
Whoa.
And it sounded terrible. It just sounded incredibly digital, but it was one of the first ones. And we also, at Stevie's studio, we had one of those early burners. And I mean, every time you'd burn a coaster and it wouldn't play, it was $250,000 down the tubes. Yeah. And I remember we'd have boxes of the blank CDs, and we'd have to keep them in a locked up cabinet. They were one of the most valuable things at the studio, you know, cases of blank CDs. Those were experimental times, because also only like one in three or four discs seemed to work. In the very earliest days, nothing was ever calibrated right. It was a complicated process.
You know, one thing I remember about when the CDs first came out, there was a lot of audiophiles that when the CDs first came out, they were the first on board to go, you know what, this doesn't sound as good.
It doesn't work.
As vinyl. It doesn't sound as good as analog. And I'll never forget that, because I remember reading just a couple little articles where they were talking about that. And I, you know, by that time I was into, you know, I believed everything I read about how great technology was.
I remember being in studios, and it was for me, it was Bruce Hornsby just had brought out an album that everybody was raving about. And that was everybody was falling in love with that record. And it was that record, people said, on CD, you could really get the best from, and Dire Straits, Brothers in Arms. Mm. And I think Avalon by Roxy Music, everybody said you got to hear that.
Yeah.
But actually, for me and Brian, you know, they put out our solo album, Q-Fill, and it was just terrible on digital. So bright and just not looked at carefully, you know. Yet there were a couple of records like that Bruce Hornsby that you had to buy, because everybody was just saying, listen to this. And it was usually in the studio we were working in, there would be a player and somebody would stick that record in. And I think that actually helped Bruce Hornsby's career at that time, because it was one of the first records that actually got, you know, sort of made a mark at that period.
You know what the first one was? The first CD?
No, what was it?
Billy Joel's 52nd Street.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Let's get a little trivia there. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And of course, you know, with the Beatles, the Beatles complained that the first ones that came out didn't sound right, and so they kept on remastering them. Yeah. And so you went and bought it again, didn't you, really? Yeah. You know, it was a great way of marketing.
Well, there was a love affair with vinyl still, and people wouldn't let go of it. So, I mean, you had this new technology coming out, and really, to be honest, it wasn't good at the time. Sorry, am I not loud enough? It wasn't good. I mean, the quality was very thin.
Yeah.
No low end.
Well, that's the next point I want to bring up is, the reality is some of those early digital machines were horrible sounding.
Yes.
You know?
The DA converters were still in their infancy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could almost see, like, the sine waves on, you know, I mean, it just had this edge to it that was just piercing. And I don't know, it was like we were so in love with the technology that we forgave a lot of the shortcomings, because we could see.
You know what, Mike?
Yeah.
There have also been a lot of CDs, especially classic stuff, that over the years have been remastered for CD multiple times.
Right.
And if the user has some, or if the listener has some spare time, it's actually really interesting. Some of Stevie's things were like that.
Right.
I think Thriller was remastered a few times too. You can go back and listen to the different generations of CDs. Like, I know on Stevie's stuff, it's a huge difference to listen to the early CDs that were mastered in 82, 83 versus the ones that were done 10, 15, 20 years later.
Right.
Same exact product. The artwork looks the same. You can't even really be sure of what one you're getting unless you look at the dates.
Yeah. I mean,
but they really sound different.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, they were using 1630s. They were using video. A video machine with the video editor to make it work.
Yeah.
And it was just, adapted. So they had inferior A to D converters, inferior D to A converters, and then an inferior transport and editing technology. So...
But the buzz was in the studio. I remember that, you know, lovely black machine, you know, Sony, and you go and push the song title, you know, the numbers, you know, number three, and it was bang, there. Then number seven, bang, and you thought, this is so cool.
Oh, wasn't a big thing DAT at the time, like digital audio tape?
DAT was
kind of related to that because it was still tape, but it was later.
Yeah, it came in a little later.
I still related to that because it was like, it was that physical tape.
There was a digital cassette that happened right around there, too, that Phyllis brought out, and it was... really a race to see what would catch on, the CD or the digital cassette.
Right.
And the digital cassette, you know, just never even came close.
Yeah. I do remember that it really took off once Sony came up with their Betamax recording setup where you would use their A to D and it would be recorded in onto a Betamax tape.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, you know, was affordable. You know, it was still several thousand dollars, but that, you know, all of a sudden people could start, man, I can master my own CDs and things like that.
Digital, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and keep it all in digital. And then things really started to sound bad. but you know, slowly towards the end of the life of CDs, you know, you really, like Rob was saying, you started to hear some really good quality.
Do you think it's the end of the life of CDs?
Oh, CDs, the days are numbered. I mean, it's
wait, let me give you some figures.
Digital sales, you sell more music digitally.
I
want to
hear what Bobby's going to say.
Right? In the United States, there are 320 million CDs sold last year.
Right.
320 million. And actually, it bumped up a little from the year before.
Yeah, man.
I'm not saying...
Thank you. I knew you would say that.
No, listen. Oh. I'm not saying it's going away, but...
Sooner or later, I agree. It's definitely... It's end of life.
Yeah.
There's no question about it, but it's just not going to happen tomorrow.
No, it's not. And I still buy CDs, but I will say that... You know, like we were saying, it's definitely, you know, on its way out. If not for anything other than you can't buy CDs nearly as
easy
as you could, you know, years ago. I mean, there's no Tower Records, there's no Warehouse, there's none of those big outlets.
But you know, you go into Amoeba and it's a funny thing. I know it's just one place, but you see lines and lines of these guys carrying out boxes full of classic albums. Right, from Gentle Giant right back to Frank Zappa.
Right. Yeah.
There's some, and classical music. This, I think, as Bobby says, I think it's, we're not quite near that space at all.
Does anyone know about Pongo?
No.
Pongo is the new service, digital delivery service that Neil Young is bringing out in conjunction with Atlantic Records. And everything is going to be at 192 24-bit.
Really?
He's already gotten Warner Brothers to sign off on 8,000 of albums in their catalog. Plus, there's a new player that goes with it. And it's like an iPod. It's kind of ugly because it's like a yellowish orange. But that being said, it's really high-quality D to A's, and it's built for quality.
Is that what he demoed on David Letterman?
On David Letterman, yes. Yeah, last week.
That's amazing. That's cool.
And he has all three of the major labels on board.
Is it just going to be new material, or are they going to go back
catalog,
stuff at that?
Yeah. Okay. Catalog first, probably.
Hmm. Wow. What if it wasn't recorded at that?
Well, I think they're hoping they can get back to the analog masters.
Oh, okay. You're right. I guess he could do that.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, let's...
Fascinating.
Yeah, say happy birthday to the compact disc.
And 30 years. It doesn't seem like 30 years to me.
That's a good run for a piece of technology.
And it's not like... I think, you know, it's not like it's going to go away tomorrow. It's going to be here for another 2-3 years, you know.
Ten.
I was going to say 2-3 years mainstay, and then it's going to kind of fringe after that.
Well, maybe, but...
I could see 10
years, yeah.
Well, data is going to stick around for longer than that, because there's just... it's still your best bang for your buck, optical storage-wise, you know. I mean, you could go to the cloud, but then your cloud dies and...
Oh, look at the picture of Rob on Skype. He's asleep. Oh, no, he's not. Sorry. No, sorry. He's
up. Distracted by someone here. I'll show you.
He's flying the Enterprise.
Bob.
He's got the Star Trek thing on. Remember we were talking about that before?
Scotty.
A little dog.
That's sweet, Rob.
This is a podcast. It's a dog on screen. It's a dog on the screen.
I'm glad you said that, because I'm going to wonder what he's doing up there. It's a dog he's holding on screen.
That's all he's doing. Yeah. I'll
let you guys narrate what's going on.
Stop doing that.
He's now petting his dog.
Thank God it's not TV.
All right, well, moving on.
That's what happens when you're bored.
That's so funny.
Is that dog alive, or are you just... it is. Okay. He's just sort of moving this white head around, you know?
It's very fierce. He's very fierce.
Okay, the mistake was sitting Brian across the table from Martin.
Yeah. I can face you the way you want.
I know. Flashbacks. Flashbacks. Flashbacks to the road. Martin, no, we have a problem. Wait. No, seriously, Martin, we have a problem. No, wait.
Put the dog away, please.
Put the dog away. We have a problem. Anyway, so CDs, 30 years, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. I think one thing is CDs really got in the groove, you know, in the 80s. And speaking of the 80s, we talked a little bit about the 80s and about your band, Q Field. And
not Q Field. We're not a f***ing farmer band.
Q Field.
You know, it's field shit. We're not folk. We weren't folk, Mike. Crying out loud. You know?
Sorry, but I had to bring it up on the last podcast.
I said field.
Q Field. I mean, you're right. It's Roy Harper.
You're right.
Folk shit.
You're right.
We were modern. Not flowerman. You know what I mean, Brian?
There's a big
all
old
it takes is a
there.
Deep end and it starts him off.
You can let it go once, but then, you know.
Q Field.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't know how we're going to piece that together, but man, 5 week break and it all goes to hell.
I love the farmer comment. That's the best part of that.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Bobby.
When have I not?
Where were you?
What if I not butchered a name?
That's true. Very true.
Anyhow, we talked a little bit about Q Feel.
Thank you.
That's it. It wasn't that difficult.
No.
It's a legendary name. Yes. It should be.
You know what? It was a legendary band.
There you go. Now I'm feeling good.
And both the albums that you sold were...
No, we only released one, Mike.
No.
Oh, my God. The study in this man's done.
That's what I mean. That's what I mean.
For sake, it was one album, not two.
No. Oh. One album and both
or
of them...
Or was it a
CD? Oh, two of them, you mean, that were sold. We feel good about that.
Should we start again?
We're rolling. We're going. We're gonna work through this. Anyhow, we talked a little bit about the 80s, and we talked a lot about the second British invasion and New Wave and things like that. But one thing I wanted to talk about is there was a lot of other things happened in the 80s that we didn't talk about, and one of them was one of the other big music genres that was breaking through was heavy metal and the hair bands back then. And the fact that the technology that influenced the big sound of those big hair bands was also kind of creeping into other types of music. And one thing that I, you know, right off the bat is the massive snare sound that a lot of those bands
AMS
had.
AMS snare sound.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you had, you know, snares that sang forever, you know, yeah. Where they had the big room and the big hit. And I just remember, you know, the first time I heard like a digital reverb, like most people I know, you go over and you get your drum machine and you get the little, I had a little 505 that I was running through an SPX 90, and then I'd hit the snare and it would just sound massive and big. Yeah. I mean, do you guys remember the big snare sounds?
We used to like mic it up and then put it through this huge gate, right? And like leave the gate open, and suddenly the gate would close fast and it was like,
yeah.
There was like a, what do they call it? Trash snare. It was trash.
Yeah, and it was like that Phil Collins in the Air Tonight kind of thing in a way. You know, but the AMS was so important to that sound. That unit was like what everybody had to have in the studio in the 80s, you know.
When you guys were doing your production, did you have that kind of a vibe where you were working with like big snare sounds, or were you, because that really didn't come out of the new wave, but you start listening to some of the interesting snares of that time that were kind of, you know, people started affecting it.
The pop side was, you know, there was a lot of pop drum sounds that came out of that era. We used to throw the drums out into a room and then, like, gate the room sound, you know, just to get that, like, real trashy, full snare sound. But it was, like you were saying, it was used with metal bands.
Right.
But it was a pop sound as well. I mean, when we came over here, we started working with Kim Carnes, and Kim was, like, She just wanted that trashy snare sound. She wrote her songs around having that sound.
It's a very interesting thing that really that
it influences you. The times, you know, if you look at the Motown era, you know, you can hear James Jamerson and the bass and the way they recorded the vocals. But the '80s, you know, you can listen on the radio and you go 80s song. You can tell because the snare is mixed so high. There's a lot more reverb,
right?
And you know, you're going to hear those Oberheim and Jupiter 8s playing the pads. And
yeah,
things,
but you know what really jumps out for me though for the '80s sound,
right?
Chorus. Everything.
Yeah.
Everything was on chorus.
That's true.
That's very true. Yeah.
Like a chorus guitar, like Duran Duran, you know, where it was a clean guitar, but it was chorused.
Well, all the synths, all the Roland synths, they had it built in, so it was.
Yeah. Everybody used it.
That's right.
Don't forget the Roland MKS-20 piano module.
Oh, yeah.
Piano.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's interesting because the MKS-20 is.
I still use it.
Yeah, but it's one of the few piano modules that. You know, tried to sound like a piano, but had a really good sound.
Its own thing,
of its own. It was kind of piano, but it had a little bit more. Bite.
I used to use it because I couldn't use a CP80 because it was so huge and you couldn't get them. But this had its own thing, and as Rob said, you put the chorus on it, and it used to be very good. This is really talking from the '80s for just back. For me, I'd use it just below the pads, just to give the pads a little bit of impact and a little bit of energy. But it was, to me, the cheap man's CP80. But it had its own sound.
The other genre of music that I wanted to touch on was, hip-hop and rap back then was really starting to get
We should leave now, Brian. We know nothing
I don't know what you're talking about.
I have
sorry.
No idea what this is.
No, but it was really starting to get its legs. It was really starting to, you had bands like Run DMC, which is probably the biggest breakout hit that people can think of, where you get a little Aerosmith, you get a little bit of rap, and it really made itself accessible to the mainstream back in the day.
Can I tell my rap story?
Sure.
So 1981, I guess, was when I first came out to California. I did my first rap session as an engineer. And a guy came in, and I had no idea what this rap stuff was. I just didn't know. And he went out, and he did a five-minute rap. And I said, you think you want to do it again? And he looked at me like I was crazy.
That
and
was
he
it.
Did it exactly the same, word for word. Every inflection was exactly identical. And I couldn't believe it. It's like, how can anybody remember all of that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then at the end, I understood what rap was, you know, from the standpoint that, oh, okay, now I sort of get it. I know what he's trying to do. But he looked at me like I was nuts. It's like, well, why should I do it again? I already did it once.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's amazing. Like bands like, you know, you had the Beastie Boys that started in the 80s. You had LL Cool J, Ice-T, Public Enemy. You know, these are just iconic, you know, groups and bands from the 80s. So we had, you know, the heavy metal, we have the rap, and then you have the pop acts like the Michael Jackson, where you can't really put them in any particular genre because they were so huge on their own. And I'm mentioning all this because if you look at the 80s and all the different genres and all the different types of music that came out, there's a real sticking staying power with a lot of this stuff that we just don't see anymore. And I'm wondering, are we ever going to see that again, the lasting, you know, 30, 40, the generational bands that you have back in that day? I mean, I think about some of the artists that are around today, and I don't know if any of them are going to be around, you know, 5 years from now. You know, there's a couple that, like in the 90s, like the Green Days, you know, and there's a couple bands that come off. But has music gotten so just so specific and so compartmentalized that the crossover mega bands, the mega groups, like you had.
To a certain extent, it has. It got formalized, from the 80s to the 90s, the early 90s, where you got it was more like a formula pop song.
Right.
And you had, instead of bands in the 80s that created their own songs, you had songwriters creating songs for artists like Mariah Carey. They had front people. And they wrote for the front people, and it became formalized, you know, from a songwriter's point of view. Anyway,
the producer too.
Yeah,
you know, producer songwriter.
Yes.
Today, basically, you have or DJ's producer.
And radio, you know, really really affected it as well. Radio
it's
would
true.
Stay with it. You know,
you're absolutely radio was
oh, that
was
drove
huge.
It, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, one of the big parts about radio was when the conglomerates took over, and you lost all the indie stations. And now you're losing all of the college stations. So there's all these outlets that at least were experimental in what they played that are kind of going away. And colleges right now, it's bad because they're trying to save money. And the easiest way for them to save money is to get rid of their radio station.
Right.
So they're selling it off because they're saying, well, we can just do an internet radio station instead. Right. It's a whole lot cheaper. Right. But that's really hurting the ability for new acts to break out because, you know, no one will take a chance on corporate radio.
Rob, what do you think? Do you think we're going to have the generational staying power of any of the bands today? Do you think they're going to be around for 10, 15 years? Or?
I think the easy answer is we always think that our generation is the only one that's ever going to have any of that stuff.
Right.
I mean, each generation will find its thing. I mean, I have no idea of what's out today that would have that staying power, but I don't doubt that something will. I mean, there are going to be people... It's hilarious to think, you know, 20 or 30 years from now, people are going to be nostalgic about Lady Gaga and, you know.
Black Eyed Peas, LMFAO.
Yeah.
I said it. Yes, that's so
bad. The room went quiet.
I know. The room went quiet.
What's that?
You know,
it might have something to do with the fact, like, back in the day, a record company would invest so much money in a band. They would give them advances. They would just pump money into an act, and the act would produce and create, and they would come out with the end result. The record company, after doing that, was they'd be damned if they weren't going to push that act and make sure they got the money back plus, you know?
Yeah.
These days, it's more like it's formulated. It's all done for the act. It's like, no, you are doing this. This is what you're going to be doing. This is the way you're going to sound. And there's a sound that's going around that is emulated. Like back when Martin and I were doing songs in the 80s, we started off as songwriters before Q Fuel.
Yeah.
And we were influenced by a lot of things. You were talking about rap and, you know, heavy guitars, dance music. But we were creating our own thing. Nobody was telling us, you know, this is what you got to sound like. We were, you know, derivatively the same as anybody else was, but we were pulling our own sound together like a lot of bands did back in the day. Mm-hmm. These days, I don't think you got that creative freedom, and there's not that investment from the, you won't get a $500,000 advance for a record company. I mean, Jesus Christ. I mean, remember those days? I mean, you were after at least $200,000 up front.
And
you know?
It was easy to get 200. 200 was
absolutely
low. Everybody would complain if it was only 200.
But we were, you know, we were in the studio with Maurice White, Earth, Wind & Fire.
Yeah.
I remember asking Maurice White, because the recording session was going on and on and on, and we asked Maurice, what's your budget for this? He said, I don't know.
Yeah.
I have no idea
when I'm finished. Yeah.
It's done when it's done.
But, you know, that still happens in some cases. I know in Nashville, I've talked to some producers. Mark Price, who does Reba McEntire, and who does, can't think off the top of my head, but, you know, again, they have no budget on some of the, you know, the A-line acts. They don't have a budget.
It's nice to know.
You brought up a good point.
But it's A-line acts, so how many of those are there? There's very few.
Right.
But I think country will have acts that'll be around for a while right now. I mean, there's still the singer-songwriter and the bands. You got some, you know, crossover bands that can absolutely draw now, and they'll be around in 10, 15 years. And I think it has to do with the fact that there's songwriting in there.
There's songs, sure. You know, there's a big difference between songs and beats.
I think a lot of times you get beats. I'm going to go make my beats, going to go do beats, going to go do the groove and stuff like that. But you're right,
some great bands that are sort of, I think, will go on from even this era that have influences from the 80s, like Arcade Fire. They have a deepness them. And a resonance about them that just seems to sound like they're going to be around.
Mumford and Sons.
Mumford and Sons. There we go. We're talking about songs and folk, which, you know, a traditional sense. And then you look at U2 that seem to glance all the way through, you know, in different styles and touch it all. But we tend to think they're going to go on because of the, again, possibly songs. And there's something a little bit more authentic and big about them that you just go, that's going to carry on. But when I listen to Arcade Fire, I feel like I'm listening back to the 80s and even farther back to, like, Can and, you know, some of the German krautrock and the way it started. You can see some of these things, I think, will survive, but do have their tentacles in the 80s still.
You know, it's interesting that you were bringing up some of the bands. There's in the electronic genre, there's bands that I think will be around, you know, 10, 15 years, like Daft Punk right off the bat. Yeah, I mean, those guys, anything they put out. Even like BT, I think, will be around. He has a really big following. He does really interesting stuff. Any of those guys that push the envelope in that electronic realm, I think, is going to be around. And funny thing is they're getting more and more influenced by the 80s. I mean, you really start to see a lot of the 80s technology come loop back around. You know, you get people that are into everything from, you know, 8-bit recording to the synth. Okay.
Drink of water.
sip of water. Heart attack, was it? Heart attack. Oh, okay.
Modular synthesizer.
Put the whiskey down.
I mean, that's huge, you know. Modular synthesis right now is huge, and you can do all that in, you know, on programs, but people like the like the modules. They like wiring up and things like that.
Well, now we can go downstairs and they have that whole row there of people who are just into modular stuff, modular synth.
I mean, I learned synthesis on a EMU modular system, and where you had to plug in and you said, okay, here's your, you know, here's your waveform generator, and you had to go into the filter, and then you had to go into the amp, and then you had to go into your envelope, and then, you know, there was something really kind of cool about that. But I'll tell you what, 15 minutes to change a patch was not cool.
Hey, Rob, what was your first synthesizer?
My first synthesizer was, what was it? I think it was the Radio Shack, whatever it was called. They had a little one-voice Moog kind of thing. I don't remember what the model was. I mean, my first real keyboard when I started getting real keyboards was a Yamaha CS, what was it called? The SK50D. Any of you ever see that thing?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I remember that. Sure.
It was two keyboards, and you could play lead lines on one synth manual and chords and bass on another. It was two keyboards. I mean, it was a massive – it was almost like an organ, but it had synthesis built in. It was really cool. That's going back a bit. And then the first practical keyboard I think I bought probably was a DX7.
And that
didn't get all the cool analog stuff till later.
Rob, that didn't lead you on to buying any more, right?
No, that was it.
How many have you got? What do you reckon? How many do you think you have?
More than I need.
I've seen it. It's a whole world, isn't it?
It's a few hundred.
Well, hey, listen, we're gonna take a break right here. When we come back, we're gonna talk just a little bit more, and then I want to also talk about editing yourself. Being as we have some amazing songwriters here. So we'll take a break, and we'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were talking about 80s and all kinds of stuff. But actually, we are honored to have another guest here, and that is Diane Poncher. She is Martin's manager, and she is just has a wealth of knowledge. And she said a comment to me during the break that I said, we got to put you on mic because you got to talk about this. And what was that comment you said?
Well, I was saying when you were sort of celebrating the 30-year anniversary of the CDs. From my point of view, that was the beginning of the end of the music business as we know it. All the things you were talking about with radio, which was so powerful at the time and had a lot to do with all the divisions of the formats and everything, no longer has that power. You don't break an artist really through radio anymore, and so many things have changed. It's affected pretty much everything. You if you're a songwriter, you look at your royalty statements, and there's still loads of sources on it, but the amounts next to it are for digital downloads, which is like pennies, and streaming, which is less than pennies. And, you know, so you have a really thick royalty statement still, right. But the amount that it totals is like a fraction of what it used to be.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting when you said 30 years for it to change an industry so much. That's phenomenal.
Yeah,
there's a reason for that, though. See, and you're absolutely right. What happened was as soon as the CD came out and everybody started to go back and rebuy their music, suddenly, and again, they're buying this, and this is free money for the record labels because they don't have to pay for production, they don't have to pay for marketing. Yeah. So all of a sudden, it's a cash cow. So as a result, it attracted Wall Street. When Wall Street came in to buy the record labels, all these conglomerates bought the record labels, and now the people that were running it weren't music people any longer. Mm-hmm. It was accountants and attorneys, and they're looking more at what would happen at the end of the quarter than they were looking at long term. So, you know, let's not take five records to break Jackson Brown. You know, if he doesn't do it next quarter,
absolutely.
That's it.
Yeah.
And that's when it began to change. So you're absolutely right. It happened in a roundabout way. It's one of those things that you don't realize. The ramifications when one thing happens, this happens, and then this happens.
Yeah.
And the record companies remain very short-sighted for a long time, which...
I mean, it is ludicrous, really, that you've got to... Your song has to be streamed something like 200 times before you're touching a penny. Mm. It's ludicrous, really, for the artist.
That would have been airplay. You
know? Yeah.
The only problem with that is, I agree with you absolutely, but here's the other part of it. In order for an online broadcaster to stay in business, they can't afford to pay higher rates. So would you rather have portions of a penny or none at all?
Oh, I understand that. I just wish they could. You know, you lose reverence for the artistic side of it. The one element that's suffering here is the person who's sat in a room creating it putting his soul into something. So in a way, and I'm talking from a very naive place, but you wish that streaming was paid a little more and everybody started to say the artist and the creator is very, very important, as much as the internet radio station, as much as the way we get this out. That we have to look at the core of this is still got to be the artist.
But see, the other thing to understand is nobody that's distributing music on the internet is making money. and this is even iTunes. iTunes, they supposedly, out of 99 cents, they make 2 cents after they take in all of their distribution costs and all of the costs for storage, bandwidth, all that. So, and if you look at Mog or Rhapsody or any of those other streaming services, they're all either right on the edge or they're losing money. So you look at it and you go, well, nobody's making any money in this.
I don't feel sorry for them.
This is very interesting. I'd like to ask Bobby, though. So, you know, with this quite desolate vision for us all, what do you think the future is going to be for us to stay creative and to have an enthusiasm about making this whole industry work and survive?
See, for me, I always think that there's a self-correcting part of the industry that will happen. And the correction will be, all of a sudden, all of these companies will need more income that they won't be able to get any other way except to go to the venture capitalists again. The VCs are going to say, no way. They're going to cut them off. And at that point, they're going to start a fall. And as soon as they start a fall, then we're going to see the correction happen, where there's going to be someone that will come up like iTunes. And supposedly now, iTunes is going to go to streaming pretty soon. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, that's going to put them all out of business anyway.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it'll be interesting at that point to see how much money actually comes back into the pocket of the artist and if that self-correction does...
Do you think they will change the rate for streaming?
Well, see, yes, at some point they will. And actually, the rate is going up. If there's a Congress negotiated a royalty rate last year, renegotiated, and every year it goes up a little bit. So now...
Well, it's the same as what the statutory rate.
The statutory rate, yeah, it's going
goes
up
according, but... Still,
it's a
struggle for like ASCAP and BMI and all those people to fight, because they always have people fighting against, which we always did with clubs And radio, we're always fighting against paying the royalty rate for airplay.
That's right.
It's no different, only it's a different
maybe
level.
Maybe it's forcing the artist, in order to survive and make money, to go back on the road. You know, so maybe that's where they make their money now. They don't make their money.
There's fewer places, though.
Yeah, I know, but, you know, revenue is at least you can get, like, a hard cash revenue from that, you know? It's like, you know, it wasn't that long ago U2 said it. You know, they don't make money at record sales anymore. They make it out of merchandise and they make it out of gigs, you know? I mean, that seems to be how you make your living.
It comes back to what we talked about in the beginning about Neil Young's Pongo,
right. Mm-hmm.
Where now it's a high-res download. I don't know what the price is. I haven't seen it. But now there's a possibility that you can actually make some dough out of this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's reasonable for a consumer to say, I will pay extra because it does sound that much better. Hopefully it will.
Right.
But,
well, you know. I think to bring this full circle, I think what Diane said was really, really profound, that 30 years ago was basically the start of the downfall of music, or the changing of music.
Recorded music.
You know, we could talk about this all night, and it's a very fascinating. But one thing that I wanted to talk about was, as I was prepping for the show in the 80s and was talking with Martin and Brian and stuff, you really get the sense that songwriting seems to be a lost art, mainly because of a lot of the technology that's around today. But every now and then I get an email from somebody and they'll ask me, you know, career advice. And first of all, don't ask me career advice.
Number one.
Don't ask me. I'm just hanging on. But
I will lead you the wrong way.
But what they do is they send links, or they'll send me a copy of their CD and stuff. And they're really, you know, good people with good hearts. But I listen to this stuff and it's, you know, some of the stuff is just flawed right off the beginning. And one of the best things I ever learned from you, Pagey Boy, was, and you always stressed this, was the art of self-editing. You always talked about being able to edit yourself, being able to take a look at yourself and really come to the right conclusions about whatever you're doing, whether it's writing a song or doing music or whatever. And I just think that's an art that we have lost. There's a lot of people out there that don't know how to edit themselves. And so I wrote to the podcast today, and I'm just going to get down to brass tacks. I mean, we're just going to get down to the basics. And I asked them to think of these three questions to finish them, these statements. You know you're really good when, and then you know you're pretty good when, and you know you suck when. And you really have to be able to answer this self truthfully. And some people are going, well, how do you know? You know, they will get their demo and they'll give it to their friends and their families. And their friends and their families, let me just tell you, your family will always lie to you. They will always lie to you, okay?
My family always talked over my demos. Every time I played the demos, it, like 5 seconds into it, they'd all start talking with each other. It used to really annoy me. They said, excuse me, my song is playing.
So all of this was motivated from a friend of mine who wants to quit his job to pursue music.
Mm. Ooh,
and I guess...
Oh, there's a reaction right there. Yes.
Because yeah, he thinks he's really, really good, and he's not. And I've been painfully honest with him. But the fact is he's been puffed up through his Facebook page and through his friends and stuff like that he's going to make some gnarly changes in his life that are just going to...
But what was the first question? You think you're really good when...
You know you're really good when...
When you think you're really good. I mean, this, you know, this guy obviously thinks he's really good.
No, but... Right, but here's the way. You know you're really good when you've been nominated for an award or two. All right. If you want to know where you are in the whole scheme of things,
you're really popular when you've been nominated.
That's a very good point.
Right. But you know, you have to be good to get some. That's another thing. You know, you're really good when you have some popularity.
But what does good mean? I mean, what's good to somebody is horrible to somebody else, and vice versa. So that's why your friend, maybe you don't dig your friend, but there's, you know,
he's not popular and he's never nominated.
Yeah, but he thinks he's really good.
But I'm just saying, you have to have some type of like point in to anchor yourself at. Like, hey, I I think I'm really good because, you know, I've had a top 10 hit, or I think I'm really good.
Oh,
or
I know what that
I'm
is.
I'm okay. You know?
I know.
I'm pretty good if you, yeah. you know, sell mm-hmm. some CDs online. You know you're pretty good.
25 years ago, Martin and I used to do these panels for ASCAP. Remember that? Mm-hmm. And we used to, you know, number one, you know, who the hell were we, you know, to judge other people's songs, yeah. right? So we're listening to other people's songs. And we are trying to decide,
stealing.
You know, yeah, who, you know, which is a great song and which is, you know, which is the one, the song with potential, which one is a lousy song, you know? And that was such a difficult decision, but sometimes it was made very easy by the fact that, you know, you get this very confident guy coming up and saying, I can't wait to play a song. And he plays his song, and it is dire. Yeah. It was horrible.
And that's exactly what I'm talking about. Yes. These are little clues that you can grab. I'm not saying it's the definite word on whether or not something's good or not, but, you know, if
maybe
you
that's
can,
how you know.
If huh. you can pick up some of these little clues, then you'll be able to,
But the thing,
the basis of what, just to end what I was saying was it wasn't that the song was good or bad. It was because I thought the song was good or bad. Mm-hmm. You know, right. So your friend who thinks he's great is he's great so because he thinks he's great. Right?
I can add to what Brian's saying is that like you brought up in the right at the beginning. You've got to do it for a while. You know, the whole thing is it doesn't happen once, and you have to go through a lot of processes before you start to feel, as an artist, where you're at. I mean, Brian and I in London would go to all the publishers and play the same demos, and we start to realise these songs aren't working, and they'd say the things like, you're not melodic enough or this, but I mean, they used to rev us up to go back and try again.
That's a good point. And Martin and Brian used to come back, and they'd take notes, and after several meetings, they'd look and see which things kept showing up on the notes. Yeah. And those were the things they'd focus on and say, this must be real, because lots of people have said the same thing.
You have to be a little bit, you get hurt, but you have to be, like all the artists have made it, you've got to be pretty pliable. And you've got to be on a mission to be real, that you're learning, and you're not going to be great right from the start. And so we picked up a lot of information, and it made us more hungry. We got upset when we didn't do well, and we were so ambitious that we would do it again. So you knew you were sucking from basically doing a lot of feedback. You can't do it on one thing. You know, you hope Brian and I in the ASCAP things we did, we'd hope that the person would go away and come back next year or next week. It's a matter of rolling over, and consistency is a big thing.
To put it in context of what you were saying about self-editing, I mean, you have to self-edit.
Right.
As a songwriter, you have to self-edit constantly. I mean, it never stops.
Well, your friend might, maybe your friend should go around to professionals and get their feedback before he quits his job.
Rob.
No, I'm just trying to hear everyone. That was not a moment of inspiration.
Well, let me answer this question then. Actually, let me finish the statement. I understand what you guys are saying, first of all, that, you know, it does take a lot of work and it does take a lot of effort. But there are definitely some clues when you need to hang it up. There's definitely some things that happen when you just got to be super honest with yourself. And
I don't believe that.
It's ever so hard. I think Bobby is right. It's very hard when you're enthusiastic to know straight away. I think it's time.
You're right. I think you're absolutely right. There is time. But when you're going to try to – okay, let's put it this way. When you've put more than, you know, four independent albums out and haven't sold any substantial numbers and have been all over as much of the social – networks as you could do as an individual. I mean, there's a clue there, you know. When you
well, it means you haven't found your audience yet.
But
it's true. You just
you're absolutely right,
Captain Beefheart. You know what?
Yeah, right.
You know, right. We're looking at Tangerine Dream. Yeah. I mean, they're not going to get everybody going like that's just marvelous. We want to break that into a single.
All right, you're absolutely right. But you know, you suck when you hear words like effort, admire, and risks on comments.
We heard that a lot.
You know? I mean, come on. I understand what you're saying, and I'm not trying to be
One of the best things me and Brian got from a demo was like, that's good stereo.
Two speakers. Left and a right.
But seriously.
Left and a right.
No, left and a right.
What tape machine were you using? Yeah.
I'll tell you what, though, Mike. I mean, I've worked with so many. So many amateur artists that have...
Thank you, Bri.
Yes.
Appreciate
mine
that.
Mine included. mine excluded. He's very talented. That have been hitting their heads against the wall thinking that they're great. And I play guitar with them. I've produced them. And after the session's over, I go, oh, my God, that's never going to make it. And it doesn't. But they come back again. Because they find the funds and they want to go back into the studio and they do it again. And, you know, what does it take? I don't know. I mean, to realize that you're not going to make it, I don't know. If you have that love and that desire,
that's the whole thing about making it. No, if you're in this business to make money, you're in the wrong business.
Exactly.
You have to be in it because you love it and you're making art. And you could care less whether you're making it, whether people are buying it. If you're fulfilling what you feel you should
be, but you have to pay the rent. Mike's talking about this guy who quit his job.
I totally agree. Listen, there's nothing wrong when you're just to make music. I'm not trying to bash anybody from pursuing a dream to make music. Everybody, I think, should play an instrument. I think, you know, it'll give – I think this world would be a better place if there was more music.
But again, as Bobby's saying, if you really want to do it, you leave your job anyway. You just got to do it. Even if you're good or bad, you just got to do it. That's
and
true.
And it doesn't matter what everybody else thinks.
He'll always regret it. If he doesn't,
that's right. Yeah, that's right.
I'm just trying to save some heartache. Okay, let's put it this way. Okay, I'm gonna go another example, and I wish I could name this, but I'm not going to.
Say his name.
A record release
What's
party.
His name?
Okay,
Where does he live?
They do a record release party, all right? Invites a bunch of friends over, plays the album, gives a free album to everybody who's there at the party, right? I would say at the end of the evening, half the people left the album there. You know, I mean, it was just that.
Yeah, but
that,
see, again, he hasn't found his audience. I'm not saying that the audience might only be 10 people, but he hasn't found them.
No, I agree. But I just think, you know, part of technology, it makes it so easy for people to make music that they're taking risks that they can't back up, you know. And I'm not trying to squish anybody's dreams, but I'm just saying people really need to –
Well, you're talking about reality.
Exactly.
What's the reality of the situation?
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. That's the whole –
It's a very thin line between – staying positive and keeping that hope up and working hard until you make it, and knowing when do I draw the line? When do I know it's not working? It's not going to work. I'm not good enough.
Rob.
Yeah, I agree. And I wanted to add to what Bobby said. You know, it is possible that you just haven't found your audience yet. But if year after year yours proves to be the most elusive audience in history,
elusive,
it may just not be worth the effort. You know, I agree there's an audience for just about anything. It's one of the reasons I always advise artists to have a sound. Even if people around you don't happen to like the sound, if it's an identifiable characteristic sound of yours, there is an audience for it someplace. The stuff that usually doesn't find an audience is the stuff that's so namby-pamby that it doesn't really take any kind of a stand.
Generic,
yeah. But I'll say, if your friends and family are all telling you you're a genius all the time and you're believing all that hype, the benchmark that I always use is wait till someone who is objective chooses to put down some money for your music.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, let somebody who has no relationship with you actually pay to want to own your music. That's a major hurdle to get over. And once you start doing that, even if it's only one or two people at first, if someone objectively heard your stuff and liked it enough to actually put down some cold hard cash, that means you're on the road to something. And if there's one or two people who will do it, there are lots of people who will do it.
Right.
But I get approached by new artists whose friends and families tell them they're great. And they tell me they're the next, you know, biggest thing. And I say, well, you know, what have you sold? And the answer is always nothing.
Right.
You know.
Exactly. Bobby.
Well, you know, I thought about when I saw your email today and those questions, I thought about it. And for me, it would be, you know, you're pretty good when other people want to work with you.
And absolutely.
And it's and then you know you're really good when pros want to work with you. And you know you really suck when you work with the pro and you feel like you're in over your head, and you can always feel it internally that the, you know, you're treading water. And for me, that having gone through all three of those, mm-hmm. you know, that's the criteria.
I think we've all been there.
Yeah.
You know, that's we've all been there. That's so interesting you say that, because you're right. When you work with a pro, when you work with somebody who's, you know, notches above you, it's a real good reality check as to where you are. I mean,
very true.
Absolutely. That is so true. Brandon.
Yeah, I had a point to make. This is maybe what you want to tell your friend. Give him a reality check as to what the day-to-day life of a musician trying to make it right now is, and a touring musician. And, you know, does he have a family at home? Is he trying to keep a relationship? Because he's got to be on the road all the time. And most of those guys in bands that are just getting going, they have, you know, they still have day jobs. You know, they come back off tour and work another job doing something. They're not making much money.
Yeah.
It's tough.
I just, my thing is I just see him chasing, trying to buy talent, you know, always spending money on the next piece of gear to sound better and to do things. And it comes down to the songs, and the songs aren't that good. And, you know, sometimes you're so close with somebody that even if you give them a negative review, that there's more than just, you know, you're really good friends. So there's all kinds of
this
things
sounds a little
playing.
Bit spiritual, but it, does he love doing it?
Oh, absolutely. And you know what? And I would never,
that's it then, isn't it?
Yeah. I would never ever squash his desire to make music, because people, you know, people have to create. Mm-hmm. You know, creating is a huge part of, mm-hmm. of who we are as people. You know,
well, look what if? I mean, I'm a huge Morrissey fan, huge Smiths fan. Mm-hmm. But if somebody came in and there had been no Morrissey and no Smiths, and he played me Girlfriend in a Coma, I would say forget it, just forget it.
Interesting you should say that, because I never got them until recently, and that would have been one of the bands I would have thought, why?
Why?
I don't get it. But yet they have a huge.
They're huge.
Yeah.
Morrissey is huge. Yeah. He's a god over here as well, California.
Yeah.
That's right.
Unbelievable. But, you know, that's an example of like maybe somebody who might, you know, from a classic songwriting and production and presentation point of view, might be told, forget it. Don't give up your day job.
It's not classic at all. Yeah, right. Yeah. It's not right. Formula.
And also, as Brandon was saying about, like, a lot of musicians have day jobs. Like, we come from a different culture in Britain, where, you know, you have this socialism where you can basically sign on to the dole and you can be a musician. So there's no real need to have a job, you know. So
is that why better music comes out of the UK?
I think that's what it is. No, absolutely. I think it's got a lot to do with it, because you don't have to give it up, you know. Over here, it's like, you know, I need, like, you know, in order to buy that piece of equipment that I want to buy, I need like $5,000, you know. So I'm going to have to work for 6 months before I can get that, you know. In Britain, you beg, steal, and borrow to get that, you know, piece of equipment.
In fact,
to
when Brian and I started as Q-Fuel, we were, you know, we had a little Jewish consortium that were actually helping us live week after
week. Two accountants.
And they were willing to give us £30 a week just to survive and to work on our four track, on the belief that we were going to turn into something, and they would have a share in our publishing. So, you know, and we were living really tough, but somebody was willing to say, you know, don't do anything else but keep doing this.
Was this on a farm?
This was on a farm. That's when the band
in
was
the
called
field.
Q-Field.
Well done, Bobby.
Nice segue. I like that.
As soon as we became successful, we took the D off.
Well, the whole point of this is, I think, you know, if you're going to pursue music, just be really honest with yourself. And that'll pretty much level out wherever you're going. It's going to take you.
It's ever so tough to be honest, though, with yourself. When you're first...
That's subjective. It really is subjective.
When you're first buzzing and you just want to get into it, you know, and I, talking about editing, you know, I never really started to really understand editing, you know, 6 years into writing. You're just so happy to finish the song. You're just so happy.
Well,
to
some people,
present
it's not only the song, and it's not only the finished product. It's their whole reason to be, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the creative process, you know, just to think that they're a creative person, that they can actually come up with a product that maybe somebody out there will like, right. You know? And they think they are good. And this, it goes back to what I was saying, you know, you're really good when you think you're good. Because, you know, if you give up on that, if you listen to that one person that says, no, right. You know something, don't give up your day job, go back, leave this alone. If you listen, then you're never going to make it anyway. You know, Morrissey, if he'd listened to, you know, to people saying, hey, you can't sing, you know, you can't sing. And he's the first to admit, I can't sing. Yeah. I don't sing.
Mick Jagger.
Yeah, exactly.
Dylan.
What do you listen to these people who say they're never going to make it, or do you just keep on doing what you're doing, you know? Yeah. And it's like Martin was saying, it's like a psychological thing. It's like, you know, it's part of your, you know, raison d'etre, you know? Yeah, yeah.
But I think you're farther ahead of the game if you can edit yourself to make yourself better. Seriously.
Well, I think when you're saying the word edit, you can look at it two ways. With Brian and myself, we'd come back from publishing meetings and say, we failed here, we've got an interest here, somebody was interested in that song. And we were a little bit mathematical about it, and we'd take notes. But nothing stopped our fire and our energy to say, although our spirit's hurt by this, we're going to go again. And you know, you go to bed at night and you think and you go, well, why did DJM say that we weren't melodic? And we went there because it was Elton John's label, you know. And I kept the letter because I thought one day I'll prove that we're melodic, you know. And so in a way, it hurts your ego, but it doesn't bloody well stop you. And you get, if you're in it and you care about it, I have to say it again, it sounds very, you know, dreamy, but if you really want to do it, you know, same thing with Bowie. You can imagine how he changed in the early years. You can imagine how many times they were said, don't do that. And if you listen to Bowie's first albums, they sound like Anthony Newley, you know, and it sounds like he's got orchestras and everything, but you can see it going into Space Oddity, and this guy was never going to stop.
He had a vision. He knew where he was going. Same as your friend.
Yeah,
your friend knows where he's going.
No, there are millions of
things. He does. You don't know where he's going, but he knows where he's going.
Nope.
That's not what you're expecting, were you?
I think this is great, but, you know, I'll be honest, we hear about the successes, but you never hear about the
failures. There's not many Bowies, there's not many of Mick Jaggers, there's not many Morrisseys. So it is a very, as Diane said, a very fragile line. And so what really counts is the vibe and energy of the person who's fighting for it, because there are some people that shouldn't be doing it, but won't stop doing it because they have to.
That's right. And like you were saying earlier, if you really love it and you follow that trajectory, you're going to end up in something, you know, whether it's post-production or whatever, you know, that you love.
Yeah. You know what? I think maybe it's managing your expectations more so than trying to manage your music.
This is a very good point about limitations. I think you do learn with it, but a big word is experience. You start to learn your limitations. You go like, I'm not great singing that, and I shouldn't be doing those kinds of songs, because, you know, we are talking about puppies when you start, you know. Robin, you've got a puppy there, yeah, so you know what that's about. But it is...
Yeah, don't remind me.
Not anymore. He ate it.
But that enthusiasm, that gasoline, is so important. And yes, you may fall off, you know, and not make it.
You know, you bring up a good point about knowing your limitations and then maybe improving on your limitations.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
I think there's
but that doesn't happen at the beginning. You never know at the beginning. It's just you're so enthusiastic and so driven, but all of a sudden you go like, oh, I'm failing at doing that. I'm not very good at that, although I thought I was. You know, I listen to my old demos and go, gracious me, that's just like a step before that, But isn't it interesting that there were 100 demos that came after that? That meant there was something not going to stop it. And
that's a process, you know, that Martin's talking about. I mean, you don't go into battle with like a single file and get it mowed down and expect to win the battle. You go in with, you know, 5 ranks. The first rank's going to die, you know.
And I have to say, me and Brian.
And you don't get that first off. You learn that through going into battle several times, right?
Brian and I myself came back with books, and we wrote everything that the A&R department said to us.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so we were willing to take the fire.
Right.
And then we go, oh, they're wrong.
That's a key there.
They're we used wrong. To use it as inspiration.
Be willing to take constructive criticism and then be realistic.
And, of course, we found somebody, which you are to your friend. We had Diane, who we knew had experience working with, you know, Prince and Earth, Wind & Fire and Ray Parker. We knew that when we played her demos, she'd see it with the eyes of working with people that were so good. But I think Diane also has mentioned to me that when she met us both, she said they're early on, that they're beginning, but nothing's going to stop them.
Right.
And that's a huge
thing.
There
was a huge potential because they were so ambitious and determined. You know, that was a huge part of it.
And, you know, you read about, you know, Bowie's career, and we know Bobby's written about it. That man had been pushed back so many times, but
he quit the business for a while.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Nothing was going to stop him getting there, and he reinvented himself. And so there's a great artist that realized I shouldn't be doing show tunes like Anthony Newley and changed. And really, if you look at the really great artists, they've changed. They've grown and they've evolved, moved. They've evolved. They've moved. They're not the same, you know.
But
You're all wrong.
No. Listen.
Why did I pick you as a panel? All wrong.
You're not wrong. I'm learning not to be so jaded. But I think the limitations. I think that's a big part.
Limitations.
What you're trying to say is, if you really heard this guy's song,
you
change your mind.
You know what? If you played the song now, we'd all go quiet and go, oh yeah.
Oh, he's right. what's his real job?
I just.
Are you sure he doesn't listen to the podcast?
He just lost.
He's going to know who he is, isn't he? Yeah.
All I'm saying is, I don't know.
You don't know what you're saying.
I don't. Not anymore. Everybody
actually, Mike believes in him. He's going to call in tonight and go, "You got it, man. You got it.
You go."
Martin Page says, "Don't give up."
If he's that bad, if he gets professional feedback, he'll figure it out.
You know, Diane and I have had a demo sent to us, and how do you speak to somebody like that? And it's really hard because you know that they're so far away, and we see it on the virtual TV shows when they're doing all this star search. You know, it's rather, you know, it's tough, but you actually, in a way, you want to say, I do really respect that they want to do it. You know, they've given it a shot.
Listen, I respect the guys just made four albums. I mean, though he hasn't sold it, that whole process of making an
album.
Did
you buy any of them as a friend?
No. But
what was wrong with them?
Well,
I mean, if you had to put your finger on
the fingers. On
something. Okay, the songs were not good. They were.
What does that mean exactly? That they weren't. The melody was bad. The form.
The melody was bad. The lyrics were bad. The lyrics were horrible. And he can't sing. He's okay. He's not bad. But he just can't sing. And for me,
does he produce himself?
Yeah, he does everything on his own because he has that type of a ego that he can't see beyond the ego. And what really I think it fails him, and what really kind of pushes it over for me is the fact that he makes decisions, financial decisions that don't put him and. I'm trying to walk this fine line, but basically, he spends money he doesn't have on equipment he doesn't need to try to make an album that's not going to get any better.
I wanted to ask Rob, because Rob gets a lot of artists, you know, coming to him. How do you deal with that, Rob? Do you when you're not sure about? Do you tell them straight on like this isn't going to work or?
I try to. I mean, one of the main things, and it sounds like your friend is guilty of this. One of the main things is people who realize there's some shortcoming in their music, whether it's performance or the songs or whatever, tend to like overinvest in equipment, thinking that's going to solve the problem,
right.
And it never solves the problem.
Right.
I'd rather hear an incredibly talented guitar player playing a $3 guitar than someone with no talent playing a $10,000 guitar. Just it all comes down to you, not the instrument. And so I'm usually as honest as possible when I talk with people. Most of the time, because if a new artist is coming to me, they're coming to me usually with the hope that I'm going to work with them. And I've just learned it's torture for me and for them to have them in over their head working on things that they're not ready to do. And one of my first warning signs, though, is if they are overinvesting in equipment, like they're so worried. We once had a singer who was not good, who came to us, and I'm going to be very generic about the story in case he's listening, but he insisted on bringing his own equipment to the session.
Oh.
Of various kinds. We said, no, you know, just come and sing. We've got all the gear we need. No, I got to bring my personal stuff. So he brought his personal stuff, and it was a terrible experience for us, and it had nothing to do with the equipment. He was hiding behind the need. You know, it's very easy to say, well, I would have sounded better, but it's the wrong guitar. And you got to get out of that mindset. You know, we've hired great singers for messages they've left on my answering machine. It's not about the recording medium. You can tell the real talent comes through. And don't hide behind things that are not the problem, like your gear. I mean, in this day and age, in the old days, maybe, yeah, if all you had to record on was a horrible cassette deck and everybody else had a beautiful multi-track, that was one thing. But now any digital recording you would do on any kind of device is good enough to get your point across.
That goes back to the quality and how it's dropped.
Don't hide behind that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also, what Brandon said resonated with me, because he said, you know, it's good to have this passion and pursue. I don't remember the exact words because I can't really hear over Skype that well. But he said, you know, this can be a trajectory towards getting into post-production or something. I think if you're a singer and a producer tells you, well, with a voice like that, you should be, you know, cutting verse slams or cutting Bee Gees or something. Tells you your trajectory is not, you know, to the top of iTunes. But just know that friends and family are never going to be honest with you. Objective feedback. I mean, it's fine if your friends and family love what you do. That's good support, and everybody needs that. But I work with so many people who take that as their only feedback. And it's just, it's not realistic. As soon as you get into the real world is going to tell you what they think of you. And if your audience is huge, you're going to hear that they like you really quickly. If your audience is tiny, like we were talking about before, it may take you years to find a pocket of people who like you. It's fine to look for those people and to focus on the people who are giving you positive feedback. But it should be people who are giving you positive feedback because they like what you're doing, not because they just love you.
Right. Well, I think that pretty much sums it up. I mean, Rob said some really good things. I think society nowadays, especially with some of the strike it rich quick, you know, game shows and variety shows and contests and American Idol and X Factor, you know, there's a generation of people that feel like they're entitled, though, that they're absolutely going to make it if they just, you know, put their nose down because they're entitled to it. And I just, all my point is you just got to be. Just be aware and just be honest with yourself. Because I think deep down, this guy really thinks he knows where he's at. I just think there's a little bit of a denial in there.
Denial's a powerful thing.
That's, you know.
He needs it. He needs to keep doing it.
Yeah.
For himself.
Right. And yeah. there's nothing wrong with doing music on your own. Because music, I do music on my own. Because it's just fun and it's just something I want to do, you know. But I don't think
I remember sitting in a London pub, North London, and I was with an A&R friend of mine, Ricky Zuckerman, who lived in London at the time. And Ricky had brought me to hear this band who he was humming and hawing about whether he was going to sign or not. And the band came on, and I thought they were so funny, not good, not talented, but I just thought they were so funny.
Right.
And they turned out to be Madness. Mm. Right. And this was way before they were they were signed. They were gigging. They were just doing London pubs. And Ricky said, I don't know. You know, so what do you, you know, the talent was there, but, you know, it wasn't obvious. It was a kind of novelty type thing. And, you know, some people have something, some people don't, you know. Does your friend have anything? I mean, does he have something that...
I'm going to keep my mouth shut.
Can't
keep in mind also, you can be successful and still be not talented.
Right.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah, true. You can. Yeah.
Yeah, he has nothing.
I mean, look at us.
But you know what? But it's really hard for me because I've been around so many quality musicians. I've been around, you know, you, Brian. I've been around Martin, you know. I just when you work with professionals and when you've been around the real deal, it's you know, it's hard for me not to judge anybody that asks me for, you know, an opinion. It's hard for me to judge them on a different level because I've been around some really great. I mean, I've toured with, you know, Steve Gadd, with Al Jarreau. So, I mean, I've worked with, you know, Robert Sweet from Stryper. So, been around good metal drummers, been around good, you know, Steve Gadd, you know, just the drumming god. I've been around great guitar players with, you know, Greg Fillinganes and the keyboards. I mean, I've just been around when you're quality people. So,
Well, that's heightened your standards.
Yeah. But you know, it's just So it's but then at the same time, you know, you're right. I can't be so hard because maybe there is a voice because there's nothing wrong with a singer or songwriter getting out there with a guitar.
It says a lot as well for something that we like, the people we like to knock a lot, which are A&R men. You know, now and then you get a really visionary kind of guy who can look at Madness or something and just go, I know a year from now these guys are going to turn into something. You know, I just have to mention, Diane again because, you know, she heard Brian and myself rule at the beginning, just pushing through. But she felt something, right? And she could see it that something was going to settle into something and we weren't going to give in. And there were hints. You know, that's a big word, hints of something that may turn into something that is worthwhile. I think we'd be surprised if the people that we idolize now, if we...
But you did have... You had obvious potential. You were inexperienced, but the potential was there, and then your personalities and your drive on top of that just was, you know, undeniable.
But it does take, you know, a person to, you know, see that and say, carry on, you know, I'm into what you're doing, even though you know it's not quite there yet. You know?
Do you remember, Brian, about, this is probably 10 years ago.
No, I don't remember
that. You came over.
Too many drugs.
You came over to the studio I was working at in Hollywood, and I was writing a song, and you played guitar and bass on the song that I was writing.
Right.
And let me tell you.
Your eyes are a bit glazed. Are you sure?
No, I'm just
nodding.
Brian has this amazing sense of melodic guitar playing that was just, it was so, you know, it was so good. It just totally, the song we were working on was really simple, but he just wrapped it in this guitar part that was just so tasty and that just, you know, supported the song so well. And I judge every guitar player that I ever work with against that standard. So
that was a lot of drugs. That took a lot of drugs for a long time.
But this actually, this ties in, Mike, what you're saying, to when I first met Brian. We were doing an audition for a band called the Charlie Mullen Band, and we had a lot of money behind us. We were developing in London, and there were... Maybe 60 guitarists were passing through one day. And I was a bass player and the kind of musical director with this band. And we just had to see guitarists walking in and playing three songs that they'd learnt on a cassette 2 days before. And you had to make a judgment. And it's true what you say. You sort of do taste the guys that are in the pulse.
Right.
This is not to say that I'm the best guitarist in the world, because I'm not. I am way, way, way far from that, because I know excellent guitarists.
My whole point with that is...
The band knew that guy's going to develop and work with us very well.
Right.
And yet we had some flash guitarists in. We had the ones that really just, you know, blew the speakers off. But you had a feeling. You went like, the guy's got the integrity to make it good.
Right. And my whole point was I've collaborated with my other friend, and it wasn't anywhere close to that. So
thank you, Mike.
You just know when you work with quality. Hey, we've gone on way too long. This has been really kind of fun.
Not for your friend.
What's his name?
You know, the next podcast is going to be, he's not with us anymore. He went to a very high bridge.
He's going to be playing his albums.
No, it's all, you know what? It's all
this
done.
This is his first album.
It's all done in love and total just, you know, I care about the guy. So having said that, probably going to be in trouble. Anyway, Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure.
This is great. We're gonna have you back more often.
Thank you so much.
We're gonna talk more than just the 80s, but we're gonna have you back. And Rob, are you awake?
Yes, Michael. Not for much longer, but I am awake.
It's getting late.
Rob, you working on anything fun and exciting that you can talk about, or?
I'm working on a bunch of stuff. I mean, I'm on the East Coast right now because I invented a shopping technology with some partners in Australia, and a business development firm is now building our company with us, and we're all based in Philadelphia for a little while, so that's what I'm doing here. But while I'm here, I brought a mobile studio, and I've been scoring commercials. I actually did another commercial today here, which is a little bit strange. I'm just working on a little tiny MIDI keyboard. And doing everything in Cubase and Pro Tools on a laptop, so it's pretty cool.
Awesome.
And then there are people working in my studio in L.A., and I'm just sending files back and forth and trying to keep all the things going on the West Coast and the East Coast simultaneously. And in the middle of all this, I'm producing a band in Austin. So when I go back and forth from L.A. to Philly, I stop in Austin, which is the halfway mark, and I work with that band. And I'll be able to talk more about that band pretty soon because they're really cool.
Great.
But I'm exhausted.
These next few months are not going to be boring.
Mike knows a songwriter that might be interested.
That's awesome. I hope he's not too good.
Brandon, how about you? You working on anything?
Yeah, been a lot of fun stuff at Trailer Park recently. Well, we finished up Batman a little while ago, working on a lot of superheroes, working on Iron Man right now, working on a giant... I don't know if I can talk about this one, but it's a movie Scott's working on. Has he spoken about it yet?
I don't know. So we're better.
Anyways, giant, big, epic sci-fi thing, which is a lot of fun. And another superhero movie, The Superhero, working on that one too. So a lot of fun. A lot of fun right now.
Bobby, are you working on anything? Any books coming out? Any new?
A couple of books and doing another lynda.com course. I'm about to go in the studio with the band, do some producing and mixing, and doing a lot of speaking. I just came back from the University of Miami doing some speaking there, and I'm about to go to Turkey to do a keynote at a conference over there.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Martin, what about you?
I'm not going to Turkey.
You're not going to make me.
Your new album's out?
My new album's out, and I could, you know, it's been really lovely. I mean, a lovely progression for the way the record's been received. So that's been really great, and the fans have been nice and, you know, getting great feedback. And I'm doing my normal thing, which is, you know, romancing songs. So I'm still writing like a fanatic. And, in fact, I've been diving back into the past to pull up some songs that are... need to be worked on again and transfer them over to the Pro Tools and having a lot of fun experimentation. The main word for me now is experimentation. I'm trying to open my skull a little bit into looking at music a little bit differently. Actually, this podcast is very useful because I think sometimes you think of not being locked into a box too much and... I'm just enjoying every time I work in the studio trying to think outside the box. I'm having a lot of fun.
Fantastic.
How about you, Mike?
I am about to release, I think it's going to happen in early November. I've been working on the last year coming up with a property, starting to produce my own content under the brand of KidSleep.com, and we are going to specialize in programming for kids to help them go to sleep. So we have our first couple of products are coming out. They're going to be basically bedtime stories that are done with full production, sound effects and characters and things like that.
And I've been very lucky to hear some of it, and it's outstanding. Really, I fell asleep right dead on.
Is there anything like go to f*** to sleep?
We love that book.
It's a little nicer. But it's about, you get about 20 minutes of story, and then you get another 15 minutes of music. So the
feeling, and they're like classic stories, aren't they?
Yeah, but we've kind of I've developed characters. Our first series is going to be about these little hamsters, Mike and Maddie, and their adventures, and we place them in classic fairy tales. And it's really fun. Worked with some fantastic talent. As a matter of fact, I can say almost all the talent has been on our podcast as a guest at one time or another, with between the composers and the voice talent. And
did you
like
get
that.
Cole Brown to do the music?
No, I didn't. He asked me for 800 milligrams of ibuprofen as a donation. But I was using it at the time.
But that's actually – that'll be kind of cool because it's totally original content. It's a property, and we'd like to see how it goes. And I'll tell you guys more about it. Right now, our Facebook page has like – 4 likes because we haven't really launched it yet, but this is the first time I've
Good
talked
luck.
About it publicly. So that'll be kind of fun and exciting. And I'm going to be a music critic too.
Wow.
No, I'm just kidding. Okay. And Brian, how about you? You doing anything fun and exciting back in music? I know you've...
No, I mean, we got plans. Martin and I are talking about possibly doing something else together. And,
great.
You know, we'll keep it under wraps until it actually happens. Right?
Yeah, that's true. It's been very, now that it's come out, it's very strong in my mind. I've kept it under my wraps, and only Diane knows about it. But I'm developing a little space at home for possibly me and Brian to vibe off each other.
Nice. Wait.
In a musical way.
Yeah, that did sound rather bad, didn't it?
Brian seems to have.
In the nicest possible way.
And you know, before we go, we got to thank Diane. Diane.
Yes.
Thank you, Diane. Kind of stepping in here.
Actually, she said the best stuff all night.
I know.
You know?
She was great.
Yeah. Yep.
So thank you for getting on mic and putting your 2 cents in and, you know, being on my side sometimes.
I was trying, you know.
All right. Well, hey, listen, if you have any comments or questions, you can contact us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And you can also check us out, check out our Facebook page. Hey, we're at like 301 friends.
Wow.
We were at 302 likes, but... I know, someone doesn't like
it. We lost one. We lost one. Find out who he is.
But no, but it's gone really good. And, you know, our podcast is going strong. We've done as many downloads as we did last year, and we've done about half as many shows because of the way everybody schedules.
And this goes all around the world. Right?
Oh, yeah. Great. Yeah, we've got fans all over the
place. Where's the biggest input? Is it like – you said Germany.
U.S.,
once,
Germany, then the U.K. in that order. So it's wonderful. Really good. So we appreciate it. And
I do want to mention that Rob looks really good on the screen, doesn't he?
Yeah,
he does.
I was just thinking that.
All right. Well, for myself and all the guys and Rob, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and West Wave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez and uses AFEX's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.